Welcome to the History of European Theatre podcast, and thanks for joining me on this journey through millennia of theatrical history. For this bonus episode of the podcast, I had the chance to talk with Dr. Agata Wuksha, author of the book Polish Theatre Revisited. Agata's work is a study of the fan culture that existed around the theatres in Warsaw in the later 1800s, where, through the experiences and behaviours of theatre fans, she examines the cultural impact of theatre in Warsaw and the way it was used in the cultural battles of the time and the fight for Polish identity. It's an interesting examination of theatre and the social culture of the time, which she peppers with some fascinating anecdotes of theatrical life, which illustrate just how much, and in some cases, how little, things have changed. I got the chance to talk to Agata from her home in Warsaw, where she is Assistant Professor of the Institute of Polish Culture at the university there. Before reading your book, I knew nothing about Polish theatre of the late 19th century. So before we talk about some of the detail in your research, can you say something about the theatre scene in Poland generally at the time and set the scene for us?
Yes, thank you, Phil, for this opening question. I think it's important to give the context of my research. So the first thing I would point to is the fact that Poland did not exist as a sovereign country in the 19th century. In the late 18th century, Polish lands were divided between three neighboring powers: Prussia, Austria, and Russia. And in fact, I would also like to underline that that country that was partitioned was not the Poland that we know. It was a dual country. It was Poland plus Lithuania. So there is no easy connection between contemporary Poland and that country that ceased to exist in the late 18th century.
Right.
What it meant for artists, for theater practitioners, was that they suddenly woke up in different legal, political realities. So cities such as Warsaw, Kraków, were in different partitions.
Mm-hmm.
Warsaw in the early 19th century became part of Russian Empire. It was the capital of what we call Kingdom of Poland. But in fact, it was totally subjugated to the Russia, while Kraków or Lviv, which nowadays in Ukraine, but back then it used to be a sort of Polish city, belongs to Habsburg Empire, so Austria. I think it's important because it shows that Polish theatre developed within very different political, socio-economical contexts, depending whether we speak about Kraków or whether we speak about Warsaw, it's not the same. The second thing I think is crucial for understanding Polish theatre in the 19th century is that it was quite recent. So public theatre in Poland, first Polish public theatre, was established in 1765 by Polish last king, Poniatowski. And this theatre was the first institution that allowed for sort of ordinary people to go and see a theatrical performance, provided, of course, that they paid for their tickets. And that was in Warsaw. In late 18th century. So then after the partition period, this theatre kind of exists and still performs under different names. It gradually became what we call the National Theatre. And from this National Theatre in Warsaw, throughout the 19th century, developed a very peculiar theatrical institution that we call the Warsaw Theatres or the Governmental Theatres. It was a theater conglomerate that consisted of several stages and several acting groups, including the Grand Theater or the Variety Theater and some smaller stages. And when we talk about Warsaw Theater in 19th century, we basically talk about this institution.
Right.
It could no longer be called the National Theater because after one of Polish uprisings in 1830, Russian authorities did not tolerate the adjective the national. That's why it was the Grand Theatre and then the Variety Theatre, etc. So my research focuses on the Warsaw Theatre because, as you see, it's kind of complicated when you want to really dig into the context. This situation is not easily comparable with situation in Krakow, for instance. Also in terms of legal realities in which the artists had to create and perform. So in Russian Empire everywhere, not only in Kingdom of Poland, but everywhere, the censorship was very strict. And for instance, Shakespeare plays were banned for as late as the 1860s. Yes, so you could see Macbeth or Hamlet in the early 19th century, but you could not see it during 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. It was banned for a while throughout Russian Empire, not only in Kingdom of Poland, because it was considered too revolutionary, so to say. And I think that what I would also like to stress is that Polish artists were mainly influenced by France. So French repertoire dominated in Polish theaters, in Warsaw theaters, together with local plays, particularly comedies. And I think that we might say it was mainly light repertoire. Of course, once in a while, the Dashan theaters performed a tragedy or a more serious play, but basically comedies, operettas, operas dominated. What I can also add is that due to this specific political situation, Polish theater and the Warsaw theater in particular became temple of Polish culture and Polish language. At least that was the image it had. Because as I just said, it mainly performed French comedies. It was still considered a center of Polish culture and Polish language. After 1863, which was another failed attempt of Polish patriots to regain independence from Russia, Russian Empire introduced a Russification policy, which meant, for instance, banning Polish language from most of the public spaces. So you were living in Warsaw, but when you wanted to go to the post office or to the train station, everything was in Russian.
Right.
And people working there were obliged to talk to you in Russian, and you were obliged to respond in Russian. It doesn't matter. It didn't matter if you know or don't Russian language. That was the official language. The same applied to schools. So Polish children could not speak Polish in public schools. Russian was the only language that was accepted. The one exception was theater. It's one of historical puzzles. Why actually did Russian government allowed for that? It gets even more interesting because the Warsaw Theaters, this theater conglomerate that I talked about, it was administered by Russian authorities. The head of the Warsaw Theaters was the chairperson appointed by Tsar himself. But still, the language was Polish, and the plays were performed in Polish. The only other institutions in Warsaw where you could speak Polish was church, and of course there was a press. There was Polish press allowed, heavily censored, but allowed. And this is probably why theater became so important for national discourse. Even though it did not perform patriotic plays or romantic plays because they were also forbidden.
Interesting, though, that they didn't see theatre as a threat. I mean, perhaps it was because it was lighthearted.
My theory is that, first of all, they needed some entertainment for Russian officials and other Russian people, like living in Warsaw. There's a large colony of Russian people in Warsaw because someone needed to administer this kind of colony. And the other thing is that I believe it worked as a contained space where Polish people could express their patriotism and not take it out on the streets. One more thing I can add about Warsaw theaters that is not so obvious to non-Polish listeners,
mm-hmm.
Is that comparing to Paris or London, Warsaw theater landscape was small. Small and elitist until 1868, there was only this one theatrical institution operating in Warsaw that, that I mentioned, the Warsaw Theatres. And only as late as 1860s, authorities allowed for private theatres to start to operate. But they could do that only during summer months, when many performers from the official theatres were, you know, on holidays.
Right.
And so in June and throughout the summer period until September, a private entrepreneurs came to Warsaw and opened so-called garden theatres that I think resembled music halls, British music halls, because they were connected to restaurants and had most of them had open air stage.
Right.
And kind of attracted also different type of audience. They were much more inclusive, I would say, and cheaper, obviously, than the Warsaw Theatre, the Grand Theatre, the Variety Theatre. But then when October, when the autumn started, these theatre groups started their touring across the Polish lands, or went back to their primary theatre institution somewhere else in some other Polish or not Polish city. So then again, throughout most of the season, it was only the Warsaw theatres that were allowed to give performances.
So there's the background. And the focus of your work is actually on fan culture around the theatre in Poland, and particularly in Warsaw. You make the point that this is towards the start of what we might think of as a modern fan culture that still goes on today, in fact, seems to get larger and larger. And it's all rather ephemeral by nature. What sources could you have to investigate there? And how do you go about research like that where there isn't much in the written record?
Yeah, just the sources were very limited, are very limited. And it's not only because theatre is ephemeral. And when you want to research what indeed happened in the auditorium or at the stage and not in the text, it gets very much complicated and complex, and how to do that. And we have many methodologies to that want to kind of understand how this kind of cultural phenomenon can be talked about. So it's not only that, obviously, it still applies, but the problem is that fan cultures, early fan cultures, were considered not worthy documentation. So there are very few sources because very few people thought it's important. It was important to write it down or to somehow narratize their fan experience. That was nothing to be proud of officially. The other thing is that even if something was archivized, there's a very huge probability that the archives were destroyed. I would like to emphasize it very strongly because sometimes it's not well understood outside Eastern Europe that we don't have archives. Like, what does it mean you don't have archives? Well, because of first theater fires, which happened everywhere, and actually everybody suffered from theater fires in terms of documentation. But moreover, particularly in Warsaw, the Second World War and the consequences of the Warsaw Uprising were really dramatic and tragic, and led to destruction of everything. So a majority of Polish archives that existed before 1945 ceased to exist.
Yes.
And these collections had to be rebuilt after the war, but obviously they were very, 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 very small comparing to what was before the war. So there are like multiple ideological and historical factors which results in the fact that we don't have sources about theater fan cultures from the past. Specifically, we don't have primary sources produced by fans themselves. And this is very problematic because the best thing to learn about fans would be to read or watch or touch what they produce themselves.
Right.
These sources are very, very limited. To give you an example, there is only one diary written by a self-confessed theater fan girl. And to make matters worse, she confessed also that she thoroughly edited it when she was an older lady. So we can imagine how much she crossed out from this diary, taking into account that she mostly wrote it as a young, very passionate lady. And then, as I said, edited it 40 years later. And she actually writes that she has burned a lot of paper while editing this work for publication.
That must have been painful for you to read when you came across it.
Yes, yes. I can't stop from imagining what she burned. You know, this is such an interesting question for me. And then another example, letters written by fans to their idols. We know that theatre celebrities, like today, got a lot of attention and they got a lot of letters. We know it from, for instance, their correspondence with their family, their own memoirs, press. It's everywhere. It's clear that people who adored these theatre stars used to write to them with many different reasons. So I started to look for such letters in Polish context. I was particularly interested in letters written to Helena Modrzejewska by Polish fans, as she was the most famous and most successful Polish actress in the 19th century. I even wrote to the foundation of Helena Modrzejewska that exists today in Kraków, and they know everything about her. They have all the sources. They publish a book about Helena Modrzejewska every year, asking for some letters from fans. And they said that they don't have any. And if I find anything, they would be really glad to include it in their collection. So finally, I managed to find two letters written by the same group of fangirls. But that was all.
So you have that and some photography, early photography from the time, and some newspaper articles.
If there are no primary sources generated by fans, then we have to find it on another way. There are few possibilities, but for instance, we can read sources that could give us some knowledge about the fans in an indirect way. Playbills are great, particularly in the second half of the 19th century. Playbills were used by theatre institution as means of communication with its audience. They were also used to kind of discipline the audience if the audience behaved in an, so to say, improper way. So improper behaviour in theatre is something that is very strongly connected to fan behaviour in theatre, because this is this kind of behaviour that became labeled as too emotional, too enthusiastic, too loud, too rowdy, etc. In other words, which defied bourgeois modes of reception that gained prominence in the second half of the 19th century. In Poland, it wasn't really bourgeois, it was more like intelligentsia. This was a class, an urban class that developed from nobility. And they set the rules. So when you look at the playbills, and I can read you an example because it's a very specific language. This playbill is from 1898. You can see a note on the playbill. The management of the Warsaw Government Theatres has the honor to notify the honorable audience that artists may only be called out during the intermissions. So, what does it mean? It means, obviously, that artists were called out during the entire performance and it disrupted the performance, and that it was a common practice or common enough that theater officials decided to somehow circumscribe it and use the playbill as a means to generally remind the audience that they don't want this kind of behavior in the theater. So you can read official records or many sources kind of against the grain to imagine what could have happened in the auditorium. The other method is to reconstruct social and material landscape in which funds lived, because it gives you a possibility to understand what kind of role theater could have in their lives, in their lived experience. And then again, I also think that we can experiment with how we write the history, because the many levels of producing the history, it's not only how we work with the archives. Of course, it's very important, but that's not the only factor, but also how we as historians today, writing from a very specific position, entangled in our own ideologies, produce the narrative. And I thought that when I was writing this book, I came to conclusion that because the sources are so limited and I work with them very indirectly, I think I can allow myself for some informed speculation and try to use some more immersive methods of writing history. And that's why the chapters of my book, they all start with a kind of historical anecdote when I try to imagine emotions and experiences and practices of people that interest me. But the way I recover these experiences is very probable, but I cannot tell that it happened for sure. So I use a bit different language to convey this, these aspects of history.
Yes, you're very clear in the book when you're speculating and when you're not. You are able in the book to construct some stories about life in the theatre. Fan culture seemed to take several different forms in the years that you cover, but they tend to focus around particular performers, as you've mentioned there.
Yes, I think you have in mind Helena Modrzejewska, but you can use her American name and say Helena Modrzeska. She was the greatest Polish star of that era, definitely. She started in a touring company, then she had a contract in Kraków, and then she moved from Kraków to Warsaw because actually everybody wanted to get an engagement in Warsaw. That was the real center. Warsaw was peripheral from the perspective of London or Paris or, I don't know, New York. But for Polish people in a Polish theater, going to Warsaw was the peak of your career. So because she was very successful, she was invited to Warsaw for guest performances. She was very well received by Warsaw public. So she got engagement in Warsaw. And this is the moment when she really turns from a, you know, popular actress into a star. And after a few years of performing in Warsaw, she started to think about international career. But she didn't want to... moved to German cities. She thought that it might be problematic with Polish audience becoming a German actress, and she didn't want to lose Polish support. So she thought about going to either England or US, and she actually did perform in London, I think. But she decided that US is a better option because she started to learn English quite late, so she could not get rid of, our Eastern accent. And she thought that American audience would be kind of more acceptable of this accent because people speak with so many accents in US. So she would just use it to present herself a little bit exotic, like, you know, East exotic countess. Yeah, but her biography is kind of amazing. Because she started in a very, so to say, improper way. She ran away with a guy that was 20 senior to her at least and married, and she stayed in a relationship with him for a while. They had two children, but the daughter died at an early age, and then she ran away from the guy and stayed in Krakow. Then she decided to make her image much more respectable and sort of cross out this past. So she married an aristocrat and got a title, aristocratic title. And then when she decided to leave Warsaw and make a career in US, she presented herself as countess. And this is how she became not Helena Modrzejewska, but Countess Helena Modrzejewska. And that was very popular with American audience. And she left Warsaw and started her American career in the late 1870s. And she was very popular, and she performed mostly Shakespeare, not only, but she became very famous for her Shakespearean roles. So she had an enormous groups of fans, both in US and in Polish lands, wherever she performed. But in the late 70s and 80s, 90s, etc., she mostly lived in US and mostly performed in US. But she regularly came to Polish partitions for guest performances. She was also very thoughtful about her public image. And she wanted to present herself as a very respectable, elegant lady. And she had something very poetic about her, very gentle. She was extremely graceful and beautiful. So she had lots of fans, also among very famous people. So in Poland, before she left to the US, it was a common knowledge that most of the artists in Warsaw were in love with her. Of course, she was married to this aristocrat guy, but she had a circle of male artists attending her all the time, writing about her, painting her, etc. And together they decided first to go to US, not so that she could make a theatrical career, but because they wanted to establish an artistic commune in the West, in California. And this is an amazing story. It actually had been an inspiration for Susan Sontag. There is a novel called In America, and it's about Helena Modrzejewska and her circle of admirers going to California to, you know, revolutionize the way of living. But in fact, sources nowadays show that she was already thinking about her career, and she just needed to stay in the US for a while with other people to have, you know, this background and an environment that was friendly to her, to organize a debut in US and start her American career. So one of the guys that was totally in love with Helena Modrzejewska was our Polish very famous, most famous writers ever, Henryk Sienkiewicz. Perhaps some of you heard about him. He got the Nobel Prize. And he was like super, super famous and well known. And his love affair with Helena Modrzejewska is at the core of Susan Sontag's novel. What's also interesting about her is that she presented herself abroad as an ambassador of Polish culture. But at a certain moment, she also kind of crossed the line and became a political actress. We don't know how much voluntarily this happened. She always considered her to be very patriotic and first of all, a Polish woman and secondly, an actress. However, that's what she publicly said. But when you look at what she did, it seems actually other way around. For Polish audiences, she became kind of a center of patriotic tributes. In the early 1880s, after the tragic suicide of a young Warsaw boy named Ignacy Neufeld. This is a very famous story in Polish theater history and in Polish history generally. The boy presented Helena Modrzejewska with a bouquet in the theater after one of her guest performances in January 1880. And it was nothing extraordinary, actually. That was a common practice that artists were given bouquets and other gifts by their admirers, fans, after the performance or sometimes even during the performance. And he gave her these flowers on behalf of himself and a group of his friends from high school. He was just 17 years old. But something weird happened, and this gesture was interpreted by Russian authorities as a manifestation of patriotic sentiments. We don't know why actually Russian authorities reacted in this way, because the boys got a permission to do that before they did, actually. So it should be okay. But the boys were expelled from school for this patriotic manifestation, as it was called. And they were also blacklisted from all other schools in the Russian Empire, which means that unless they were very rich, they could not continue their education. But sometimes when it happened, when you got blacklisted for your patriotic actions, you could go abroad to study. But it's very probable that they did not have financial means to do that. So as a consequence of that decision of the authorities, Ignacy Neufeld killed himself. He shot himself, it's not obvious where. Some sources claim that he shot himself at school, or some sources claim that he did that at his own home. So it's all very unclear. Anyway, his death really made Warsaw elites angry. It was on the brink of, huge protests. So the authorities decided to reinstate other boys to school so that they continue their education. And Ignacy Neufeld's funeral was sort of patriotic manifestation. So this situation made Helena Modrzejewska, in the eyes of Polish audience, a political patriotic actress. Even though, as you look at this story, she didn't really play an active part in it, but she was at the center of the boys' attention.
And he was part of this group of young men who were going to the theater a lot and were responsible for some of the boisterous behavior that you mentioned earlier.
I'm not sure if these boys in particular, because the behavior of young boys at theater changed and depended on the performance, depended on the stars that were performing. Fans of Helena Modrzejewska generally were accepted by establishment because she was accepted by establishment. She sort of legitimized fan practices because she was so respectable and elegant and patriotic that it was okay to be a fan of Helena Modrzejewska. But of course, there were other stars and other performers that had their fandoms. So the most infamous groups of fans in Polish theater in Warsaw were fans of two ingenue actresses that played young girls, young, naive, beautiful, sweet girls. Yeah. There were two of them in the Warsaw theaters. And after one of the performances, when they performed together, that was just one of many French comedies, nothing special, two factions emerged in the Warsaw Auditorium that engaged later in what we might call, using contemporary language, pantagonism, our fandom war. These actresses, I will tell their name, were Maria Wisnowska and Jadwiga Czaki. Their fandoms were very, very active. And they engaged in kind of bloodless battles in the auditorium. They occupied the upper gallery because that's where the tickets were the cheapest. And these boys were mostly from secondary school, so they were young and penniless. They gathered in the upper gallery and divided themselves in, two groups and actively participated in the performance, supporting their own idol or trying to discourage the rivalry actress. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine what was happening. Let's say that Maria Wisnowska enters the stage. At this moment, all fans of Maria Wisnowska start to clap and shout and welcome her to the stage very, very loudly. At the same moment, fans of Jadwiga Czaki starts to hiss at her in other ways, try to stop her from performing. So now it depends which faction is louder, how the play will develop, and how she would perform. Then again, they would ask the performers to repeat, for instance, the scenes that they particularly liked, which meant that the intrigue could not develop according to the script, because at different moments, fans demanded the monologue or the dialogue to be repeated because they really, really liked it. And they could not go on to, you know, YouTube and fast forward or whatever. So they used their own bodies to influence how the performance looked like. So this kind of behavior, like clapping, shouting, howling, hissing, you know, this repeating curtain calls, etc., were very common among fans. But the most influential and powerful parts of the auditorium, meaning the cultural establishment, was really, really strongly against that kind of behavior in the theater in the late 19th century. And that was typical not only for Warsaw audience, but we can observe this kind of clash between very emotional and spontaneous reactions of the audience and the emerging norm of behavior. We see this clash in different parts of Europe, in different cities, and also in the US. So it only depends on the local context what kind of social group was trying to impose the system of norms and values on the rest of the auditorium. In Poland, as I said, or in Warsaw, that was the intelligentsia class who was trying to turn theater into this, you know, temple of culture rather than a sports stadium. And I think it's also a great comparison that very often 19th century theater audience behave in a way that we now reserve only for sports stadium and for sports fans, not for theater. What I actually liked about this, so to say, rowdy behavior in theater is that, for instance, it was common to come to the auditorium whenever you wanted, because people could not turn on TV or go to the cinema. They went to the theater, of course, if they could afford that. But how many times can you watch the same play, the same performance, for 3 or 4 hours? Because these were long performances with long intermissions. So people had their favorite parts of the performance and would come only to see that part. It's even reflected in opening hours of theater box offices. So most of the performances started at 7 p.m., but the box office was always opened until 9 p.m. at least. Because many people would skip on the first act because they really like the second act or the third act. So why sit in the theater for 3 hours if you just want to be there for 1 hour? And also they would leave the auditorium whenever they wanted, if they were no longer interested and had other business to attend. They also, I think similarly to contemporary audience, very often came to see the star. So they weren't really interested in the entire performance. They were interested to see their beloved star. And it's a funny, well-known case with Helena Modrzejewska when she was still working in Warsaw. So thanks to her, Shakespeare came back to Warsaw stage because, as I said, she was a great fan of Shakespeare. And she really wanted to play it in Warsaw, so she had her ways with the authorities to convince them that Hamlet is actually a family drama. It has nothing in common with power struggles, so it's really okay to perform it. And thanks to her, Hamlet could be performed in Warsaw. And of course, she played the role of Ophelia. So what Warsaw audience did, they stayed as long in the theater auditorium as long as Ophelia lived. After Ophelia's drawing, people would leave the auditorium because they were no longer interested, to such an extent that actually press called the the play Ophelia, not Hamlet, because it was obvious that everybody went there just to see Madrzejewska. The same was with Antonius and Cleopatra. It was called Cleopatra because it was clear that people just want to see Madrzejewska as a Cleopatra.
And maybe that brings us on to another part of your book where you talk about the international tours that did come to Warsaw, even though it was kind of a bit on the edge of European theatre at the time. But Sarah Bernhardt, a huge star at the time, came to Warsaw. So she must have had a great fan following, perhaps even before she arrived.
Yes, so Warsaw was on the periphery, but it was well located for everybody that wanted to perform in St. Petersburg or Moscow. So very often Warsaw was, you know, just a stop between Berlin, Vienna, and the major Russian cities. So Bernhardt actually came to Warsaw three times, but I think the first time she performed in 1882 was the most important and had the biggest impact on Polish theater history and Polish society, and I think on Polish women in particular. So, of course, it's hard to say how many people would describe themselves as admirers of Bernhardt without previously seeing her. Then again, some members of Warsaw audience could have seen Bernhardt before because many people from Warsaw, from establishment, traveled to Paris on a regular basis. So they were familiar with French culture and French theatre. But for others, they could read a lot about Bernhardt in the press. So we're in the 1880s, and these are already times where when performances, guest performances, are preceded by a press campaign. This means that local press on a regular basis published articles about the star that was to visit the city. It could be bad press or good press, but they spoke about her. I think it's very telling that people crowded for tickets for Bernhardt's performances. We have records that people stood in a line already at night before morning opening of the box office when it was known that the tickets would be released.
Right, so clearly there was a lot of buzz around the fact she was in the city, and that was presumably some of her classic roles.
Yes, obviously. She started her performances in Warsaw with La Dame aux Camélias, very famous role because she was dying standing in the end of it. So yes, people were very, very excited about her coming to Warsaw, but most of the critics before seeing her did not write well about her. She was considered by Polish theater people as a kind of celebrity in a negative sense, meaning that she is well known because she made she was well known because she made lots of scandals, and that was how she got the attention, and not due to her acting abilities or, you know, artistic mind. This point of view changed after Bernhardt performed in Warsaw. So even those critics preferred Madrzejewska and her acting style, which was called back then a sort of idealist way of performing, like more poetic, like showing your characters only in a good light, you know, like being beautiful and elegant, nothing drastic on the scene. That was how she performed. Bernhardt was called a realist, which sounds funny today, but if we compare 19th century acting style with what happened next in theater with the great reform, but back then she was called a realist because, for instance, she used to, or that was the rumor, she used to visit hospitals or mental hospitals to study, living people, and copy their behavior and mimics on stage. So that was something unacceptable for Modrzejewska. She could not hold up her respectable image of a Polish lady and study in mental hospital. But even those people, those critics who were in favor of Modrzejewska, actually admitted that there was something very extraordinary about Sarah Bernhardt and her presence in the theater, how she mesmerized the audience, and that she was absolutely unique as an artist. However, the appreciation of Sarah Bernhardt as an artist did not mean Polish elites would like their daughters and Polish girls in general to mimic Sarah Bernhardt. And that's what probably happened. I'm saying probably because the sources are very indirect, meaning there are plenty of satires, caricatures, and other disciplining press articles that ridicule girls' behavior and their imitation of Sarah Bernhardt's outfit and behavior. So Sarah Bernhardt built her image on eccentricity, and she was considered a great artist, but a freak. You don't want regular Polish girls to be freaks, because this is where the future of the nation, you know, lies. So Polish girls were very, very heavily disciplined in their behavior and in their relation with their bodies and their life decisions. This is a common pattern from anthropological point of view. It's a common pattern for societies that do not have a political sovereignty. So they kind of cultivate this national culture and concept of nation through a sort of cultural and biological reproduction. So that was very disturbing that suddenly Polish girls started to dress like Sarah Bernhardt and started to think about, you know, relationships outside of marriage. In this case, I think it was much easier to be Modrzejewska fan than Sarah Bernhardt fan, because fans of Modrzejewska were, most of the time at least, were not ridiculed in the press. And this is what happened to fans of Sarah Bernhardt. I think it's also very much connected not only to the fact that Sarah Bernhardt was French, meaning that she was not Polish, because that's the basic problem. She was not Polish. but also because she was partially of Jewish origin. And this is the moment in Eastern Europe where anti-Semitic atmosphere and climate is really getting stronger and stronger. And throughout 1881, there were already pogroms in different parts of Russian Empire. And shortly before Sarah Bernhardt arrived to Warsaw, there were also anti-Semitic riots in Warsaw. It was like a week before or 2 weeks before she arrived. We can imagine that it had a profound influence on how Sarah Bernhardt was perceived. We also know that people were anxious that her performances would lead to another anti-Semitic riots in the city. Luckily, this did not happen, but there was social fear that her performances, her being in Warsaw, could again stimulate such social riots.
My thanks to Agata for taking the time to talk to me. If you'd like to read more about Sarah Bernhardt's time in Warsaw, the Warsaw Fandom Wars, the female fandom circles, and the Japanese vogue that gripped Warsaw at the turn of the century, a really interesting trend that we didn't get a chance to speak about, then Polish Theatre Revisited by Agata Wuksha is published by the University of Iowa Press in their Studies in Theatre History and Culture series, and is available online, or you can order it from your local bookshop or, of course, from your local library. I've put some links in the show notes and on the guest page on the website. And I'll be back next time for more Shakespeare and Johnson.